Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For many of us, StoryCorps on Friday mornings on Morning Edition has become a part of our routine. A few minutes to listen, learn, reflect, and often shed a few tears. But when StoryCorps debuted back in 2003, it didn't sound like anything else on public radio. Stories that weren't driven by news or cultural events, stories that didn't feature newsmakers, just normal people sharing memories, a snapshot out of their lives. We quickly learned that those normal people were extraordinary and that we all have stories to share. In fact, in 2008, StoryCorps created a new holiday, today. It's known as the National Day of Listening, a day to set aside time to record the stories of families, friends, and local communities. The Day of Listening has inspired many families to sit down and share their stories on the Friday after Thanksgiving. And today, we're going to share some stories. We were fortunate to have the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines this past summer, and this hour we're going to listen to some of the many stories collected from Iowans while the booth was here. In just a moment, we'll hear a conversation Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters had with his brother about the unexpected loss of his brother's wife, Christy. But first, let's hear Clay reflect on what it meant for him and his brother to have this conversation together. Here's Clay at a recent listener event talking about his StoryCorps experience. He started by remembering the day he found out that Christy had been in an accident.
Well, it was January 19th, 2016. It was just 2 weeks ahead of the Iowa caucuses. That day, I had finished up on a couple stories for NPR. Rewind back in your mind, Ted Cruz was doing really well here, and Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton were duking it out. And I was standing in between the newsroom and the studio, and I got a phone call from my brother. And my brother's 5 years older than me. We don't call each other that much. So I knew something was up, and he said, "I need your help." And I said, "Okay, what is it?" And he said, "Christy, his wife, who he started dating when he was 15 and she was 14, was driving down to Kansas, had some bad road conditions, was in a car accident, and she's dead." And I immediately fell into the role of his main support. And he has two sons. One is now in third grade, one is now in kindergarten. And my mind immediately went to, how are we going to break this news to his kids, to her parents? Over the course of the immediate aftermath, my role has changed a lot over the last year and 8 months. And the one thing that's been common through all of this has been continuing to have conversations about what is going on. Even if it's the same thing you've heard time and time again, this is not something that you talk about. It's not something that you're ready for. When someone dies and you go to a funeral and you talk to those that are closest to those who have died, you don't know what to say, let alone somebody that was 36 years old, healthy, just started a family. You need, it's healthy to talk it through. And so we'd had all these conversations, and I saw this as an opportunity, number one, just to sit down, still a year and 8 months after something had happened, and to just talk about it and to chart it out. I also saw it as, too, something that was close enough to the time when it happened to have some kind of archive for his sons to hear their father talking about their mom's death with their uncle. And I also thought, you know, if StoryCorps can get this to one of their partners and they can do something with it, the more people are talking about grief and the process that happens in the aftermath of that, the better, because so many people go through this and you don't even realize it till they're coming through the woodwork.
A few months ago, Iowa Public Radio Morning Edition host Clay Masters and his brother Matt met together in the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines to talk through their grief in the wake of Matt's wife's death. His wife, Christy, died in a car accident a year and a half ago at 36 years old, leaving behind Matt and their two young boys.
One thing that I really noticed over those first few months, and especially right after it happened, is that people don't know what to say.
No.
And people don't know how to talk about it, because it's not somebody that died in a car accident at 36 years old with two kids and a husband. You're not prepared to even talk about it, right? I mean,
yeah, there's no comfort in hearing that she's in a better place, because the place she was at was, you know, she wasn't sick, you know, she was in a good place before. So, and you know, as far as people saying they don't know what to say, I always thought that was a pretty genuine thing to say, or I can't imagine. Yeah, me either. I know, it just, you can't. You don't ever think, when you're thinking about your story and happily ever after or whatever, you don't ever think it's going to end like that.
A few months ago, you said to me that I was really helpful throughout the process of all this. I'm curious to know, what did I do that helped you?
Well, you were there. I mean, you were there. So many people say, you know, whatever you need, give me a call. And that's a genuine thing to say, because people don't know what to do. You just were there. You just knew that you needed to be there and to give me a call. And I'm a very extroverted person, and I work things out verbally. Sometimes that's annoying to a lot of people that aren't that way. But you at least knew that about me, and you knew that I would need somebody to bounce things off of. So, yeah, you'd call me 6 times a day, and I wasn't always able to answer, but I at least knew that there was somebody out there. And it's always there, you know, and it's a scar that you can pick at, and you can get messed up with it.
It's not healing, it's figuring out how to live and to live with, because you don't want it to go away.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
Another question that I often get when people ask about how you're doing, I say, he's doing as well as he can, you know?
Yeah.
He's doing it. And then the next question is always, well, how are the boys? And I don't even know how you answer a question like that. And I'm. Do you get that question from people?
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at a dad and think, how can he raise kids? I mean, I don't. That doesn't sound right, I guess. But I think people think that way. I think I'm convinced that there are people in my life that didn't think I was possible to keep clothes on the back, like my kids' back, and keep them bathed. And I mean,
but you figured it out.
Yeah, I did.
They have clothes on every time I see them.
Yeah, they do most of the time.
I mean, I look at you and see somebody that is much more confident in himself, more than you've ever been.
Yeah,
and I still see the pain in your eyes a lot, but I know you've found a place for it.
Yeah. Yep. And that's all you can hope for. And if I looked at it also as if you didn't deal with it, if I would have drank a lot, I mean, you're just going to put off dealing with it. And so I didn't have anything to drink for, 6-8 months, you know, and even then I didn't drink a whole lot before, but that sort of thing just makes you not deal with stuff. So I don't know. I've really tried to deal with it and be present and be there for my boys too.
Do the kids talk about her much?
Yeah, we talk about her frequently. Ty, you know, he was 3 when she died, and for him, I think he tries to talk about her just so that he doesn't forget. And then I think Zach's a little bit that way too. I mean, he was 7, but he's got he's got a better grasp on memories at 7 than you do at 3.
I remember on his birthday last year, I went and picked him up from school early. And I remember you telling him that I was going to take him out. And when he came out of school, he was looking for me. He had a look that I know in an older brother really well. Like, okay, where is this moron? And like, he saw me and I couldn't give him a head nod and he smiled. And we went and got, I asked him if he wanted hot chocolate. It was November. And he said, nah, not really. We could go to get frozen yogurt. And so mm-hmm. I was like, okay, let's go get frozen yogurt. And I remember sitting with him and saying to him, I can remember him early on saying he didn't want to talk to you about mom because he didn't want to make you cry. And I can remember saying to him, you know, if you need to talk to me about anything, you know you can, right? And he said, yeah, I know. Kind of like, why are you even bringing this up? Mm-hmm. And then I said, I'm really proud of who you are and how you've been there for your dad and your brother. You know that, right? And he said, yeah, I know. And I think it was, his way of, I think it was him showing me a little bit about how he's coping with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you don't know where life is gonna take you. You don't know what's around the next corner. I think if anything, this whole experience has taught me that cherish things, you know. You hug those you love harder. I mean, you do. And don't close your doors on opportunities and new friendships. And be there for people that need it, if you can be. And if I can do something for somebody that is in that sort of a situation, you know, again, I can't say that I have, but if I have, you know, you do it. You know, don't ask, just, you know, bring something, do something.
Just be present.
Yeah, be present.
Thanks, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Love you, brother.
Love you, too.
A conversation between Clay and Matt Masters, brothers, recorded this summer at the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear more conversations that were recorded in Des Moines this summer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, on this StoryCorps National Day of Listening, we're doing some listening. We're listening back to some of the many stories recorded by Iowans when the StoryCorps mobile booth was in Des Moines this past summer. Sisters Carla Hall and Ellen Jansen recorded a conversation with StoryCorps this summer, but this wasn't their first experience. The pair also came to the StoryCorps mobile booth when it was in Ames in 2006. In that first interview, they reflected on their childhoods, but a lot has happened over 11 years since that conversation. Neither Carla nor Ellen lives in Iowa anymore, and the sisters live further apart than ever. But their closeness has not changed. They make an effort to spend as much time together as possible. They return to Des Moines in August to record this conversation, beginning with Carla.
So what comes to mind when you think of some of the fun adventures we've had over the last 10 years?
Well, I'm going to guess that many of ours are probably the same. But one thing that I really enjoyed is that the running that we've done, obviously the most memorable one, was our DC with the Marine Corps Marathon for you, and I did the 10K. And it was just a fun time to be together, obviously, but it happened to be that Superstorm Sandy was bearing down upon the East Coast at that time. So right after the race was over, Sandy more or less hit shore later that day, and people had told us to try to get out, and we were too exhausted. We're like, we can't leave. There's no way we're getting out right now. And we were stuck there for an extra 2 days. It was a tough time in my life personally. And even though I was sad to see that so many people had devastation from that storm, the time that we spent together was just invaluable.
And that was one time, too, that it was just the two of us. So it was very fun. And we enjoy so many of the same things. Mm-hmm. So it was just like, you know, I'd like to do this. Great. Me too. Let's do it. And it was so easy and enjoyable. And looking back, that was probably the easiest recovery after a marathon I ever had because I could just rest. And we couldn't really do anything. Everything shut down. And we just watched TV and hung out. But it also was meaningful, too, because you shared with me some of the things that were going on with you. And, you know, I was so glad we were able to be together then to share that in person. And so that was, timing-wise, I look at that as a huge blessing.
Definitely.
To have had that extra time together from Superstorm Sandy. And we're probably two of the few people who look back on Sandy with fondness. Like, it was a great time for us.
Another one that was very memorable was my 40th birthday celebration. I decided that I wanted to go to South by Southwest, which had always been a goal of mine, and I decided I wasn't getting any younger. I needed to go while I could still stay out late. And so we went to Austin in March and spent several days down there, and it was a marathon of a different sort.
I remember thinking while we were there that I had never felt so uncool in my life.
Me too.
As while we were there, just, you know, clothes and hair. And then the funny thing is that after going, when I would tell people about it, I had never felt so cool. People would be like, what? You went to South by Southwest?
I know.
Yeah. But another, so thinking of other memorable moments shared, I would certainly say when I got married a few years ago was another memorable moment, so I'm going to get teary on this, of course. But then when you came for my shower.
Yep, I had that on my list, too. That was a very memorable moment. I was so happy to be able to do that because I didn't know if I was going to be able to. And I decided rather than tell you I could make it and then disappoint you or myself, that once it worked out, I worked with Dawn and Marcy in order to show up at your door the night before the shower. Yeah, I get teary thinking about it every time afterwards because that's one of the best surprises. I was so happy to be there.
Yeah, when I saw you there, I just couldn't believe it. Like, I was so happy and surprised and like, what? How did this happen? But just even then I cried because it just meant a lot to have you there. I mean, if you had asked, like, who would you want there most of all, it would be you.
Maybe our last question could be the perfect day. Describe a perfect day for you now. Because we asked that, you know, 11 years ago, what would be your perfect day, both as a child and then at that point in time. So what would you consider to be your perfect day now?
Well, I was thinking about this, and really some of these last few days have been perfect days, just spending them with you and yep. Doing things we both enjoy. And I was going to say very much the same thing. Whatever it is, even if we're just fixing a meal, for me that would be a perfect day.
Sisters Carla Hall and Ellen Jansen at the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines this past August. Rajiv Madika and Dennis Kelly have two things in common. One is Rajiv's mother, Irmala. As a volunteer for hospice, Dennis helped care for Irmala as she was going through the process of dying. But before Dennis could meet this extraordinary woman, he had to overcome the second thing the men had in common, a fear of confronting death and mortality. Rajiv and Dennis came to the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines to talk about how they got past the fear so they could embrace the time they had, the lessons Irmala had to teach them, and a deep friendship. It all started with Dennis knocking on the door of Mercy Hospice in Des Moines.
I had to take a deep breath because for some reason I knew that when I opened that door that I was going to step into a world that, you know, may kind of shake me up a little. So I opened the door and I walked in and I was so hoping that nobody would be there. I really didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to be there, but I knew I needed to be there.
I'm so glad you said that because that's my biggest fear, too. When I opened this door, on the left side, there's a little chapel, and they light a candle every time someone's passed away. every time I opened the door, the first thing I would look was on the left and pray, let there not be a candle burning, you know, because that would mean someone passed away. And I was not thinking about, here's a person who is no longer in pain and is now at peace. So the history behind this is my mom had cancer and she was going through, it came back in 2002, and she went through chemo and radiation, and it wasn't working. And, you know, I was fighting. And the doctor said, we got to keep your mom out of pain at this point. Let's move her to the hospice. It's like, no, you don't understand. Hospice means end of life. You're talking about my mom here. Then you accept the fact that, okay, we are at a point of no return. Let's just, now it's all about my mom at this point. It's not about how I feel. It's what we can do for her.
And so I got this phone call at work, and they said, we have this lady here, and she has asked if we offer any kind of alternative healing options. We really don't, but we do have this volunteer. And I think they're thinking, we have this kind of strange volunteer. And he does this thing called Reiki. And so Mila got very excited about this. So I went over and I introduced myself. And, you know, just instantly, just bang, there was that connection.
So my mom's name is Urmila, and everyone called her Mila. And my mom had this 2-foot rule, if you remember, because I was not married at that time. And if you saw that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, that is nothing compared to an Indian mom who has a single son. So the 2-foot rule is that anyone within 2 feet of her who didn't know I was single should know about it.
And so I would sit with her, and naturally she would start to tell me stories. And so she would talk about her son, Bart. And now Bart, you know, he's married. He's got 2 lovely sons. He's got this beautiful wife. And he's a doctor. And then I have this other son.
The black sheep. And, you know, the bar dropped for her. Like she said, oh, we need to get you a girl from a nice family who's this, you know, who's patient, you know, educated. And then, like, well, as long as the girl has a pulse, you know, we still need to get you married. And like, Mom, don't worry about me. Just, you know.
I really did feel like family. And you know, it's kind of funny because there would be times I would be with your mother and she would have friends or family come in. And I would get up to leave, and she would grab my hand and say, where are you going? I said, well, I want you to, you know, enjoy your family. She said, you are family.
You know, here we are in Des Moines talking about something, about 2 families who would have never had a chance to even meet. And here we are, you know, recording this for future generations.
And the thing is, I remember how scared I was to open that front door of hospice. We never know when we face our fears what will come out of it. And boy, it's just been amazing.
Dennis Kelly and Rajiv Madika. Their conversation was recorded at the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines in August. Mental health circumstances and diagnoses affect a lot of Iowans. And in this next segment, we hear from Peg Smith, who talks with her daughter, Lindsay Mabe, about how bipolar disorder has affected their family.
Well, Dad had been suffering with various mental illness diagnoses for at least 20 years. And on September 25th, 1992, he chose to end his life. And that was the saddest day of our lives. I mean, if we knew back then what we know now, it could have been different.
Is there any one memory that stands out, good or bad?
There were a lot of bad times that were really tough. I think one of the hardest days was the day you were a baby. I was carrying you in my arms, and your two siblings and three neighbor kids were over at our house, and he was very depressed, and he was threatening suicide with a loaded gun. So I was trying to manage the six of you children and him with a gun. And somehow someone was able to call 911, not me. So all of a sudden the house was surrounded by six police officers with their guns loaded at and pointed at us. And they were very kind and gracious, but they came into the house and they talked him down and brought him to the hospital. But it was a very scary day.
Wow. I can't believe you went through that.
Yeah, I can't either. When I think back, it seems like a different life. I think there were also some things that affected him that really were not helpful. There was generally the feeling back then that if you would just do this or just do that, you know, and in his case, he was attending Bible college. So if you just read your Bible more, pray more, something, it would all go away. And even yesterday, I saw a sign at a church that said something about if a person who has a Bible that's falling apart is a sign that you're not falling apart. And I just thought, that's so not true. His Bible was falling apart and he was falling apart. And it's just not that simple. And it really is a brain illness. It's not something you can just talk your way out of.
Well, I recently decided to talk more about my story in public because it developed even after he died. And we thought, I think for a long time, that our experience with mental health circumstances were over. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 17, February of 2006, and I was acting strange for a while, and it was pretty confusing to me at that time. My memories are kind of a blur.
Do you want me to tell you what I remember about it?
Yes.
Well, you were usually a very energetic kid, but then I'd seen you feeling a little down that year of school. But in late January, you got the worst case of the flu I'd ever seen. You were flat on your back for a week, like fever of 104, 105, just aches, chills, just the works. You were so sick. And then over the weekend, you seemed to magically bounce back. And everybody was thinking, how did she go from being that sick to that energetic? And you were talking fast and laughing loud and crying and staying up late and talking about all these epiphanies that you were having of amazing things that you could do. You're going to build furniture and learn new languages. And none of that was too surprising because you already had done some of that. But by the end of the week, you were saying that you thought maybe you had been slipped some drugs and you were acting so strange that we really thought maybe that's what had happened. And we didn't really think you would do that, but you said someone had been sneaking them into your food and drink. You were pleading with us to take you to the hospital, and you wanted all of us to get drug testing because you were pretty sure we were all high or drugged or something. And by that time, we decided we need to get this figured out right away. And so we got you to the hospital, and I still remember bothers me to this day, but that your heart was racing, you were breathing fast, you were talking nonstop, and one of the nurses whispered to one of the other nurses that she's got to be on meth. And I just panicked and thought, my daughter's on meth? I just couldn't believe it. And then they took blood tests, and the doctor took me in the hall and said, she has absolutely no chemicals in her system. It's all a brain malfunction.
Lots of brain chemicals going
on. Yeah, lots of brain chemicals that were firing. And so it was kind of a relief to know that the girl that we knew was still the girl that we thought we knew. But then you were taken to the hospital, and it was really devastating to watch them admit you. And I just cried for hours. we say this a lot, but life is just one series of making adjustments after another, and we've had to adjust. You've had to adjust to an illness, and sometimes that took 5 years to make the next step. But, I mean, really, that's what everybody's doing, is just one set of adjustments of new circumstances after another. You know, what I want to say to you is that how much I love you, and I am really proud of you, and I think you are very, very brave.
Thank you, Mom. I would say the same thing back to you. I love you so much. You are so brave also.
That was Lindsay Mabe talking with her mom, Peg Smith, about her bipolar disorder and her father's death. Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear more stories from Iowans collected at the StoryCorps mobile booth. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, on this National Day of Listening, we're doing some listening back to the stories collected by the StoryCorps mobile booth when it was in Des Moines this past summer. In our next story, something we don't usually hear about happening in the United States, an arranged marriage. It was surprising for Jeffrey Means when his son decided to become engaged to an Indian woman he'd never met. During this conversation, we hear Jeffrey talking with his wife, Diane Glass, about the day they found out that Jeffrey's son was to be married to an Indian woman they did not know.
Well, he'd lived there for 3 years, you know, and had served as an assistant to a swami there for a while. And so he knew quite a few people, and then he had come back to the States and at some point somehow made a decision that he really liked the Indian culture and wanted to marry a woman from India. So he put the word out and they located this young woman, and he went over to visit her and her family, and they liked each other, and so they decided to get married. And you know, I'd never been to India. I didn't know her, hadn't met her, didn't know anything about her family. They didn't know anything about our family. Aaron reported that their concerns were that he came from a divorced family, so that was difficult for them. They wanted their daughter to be secure. And then he had no caste. And in the Indian culture, caste was very important. So they didn't know quite where to put him. So it was a big risk for them and for their daughter and for Aaron. You know, I think by the time your kids get that age and they make some life decisions that you really don't have a lot of control over, so it was a strange experience. It was puzzling. It wasn't anything I had expected. Kind of came out of the blue. But I guess I had faith that somehow it was going to turn out. And it's turned out very well.
You know? Saraswati is a dream. Right. I never had a daughter. I never had children. I always wanted a daughter, and she's become one. I remember meeting them at the airport. This would have been in 2003, in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and she rushed over and kissed my feet and said, "Mummy G," and I thought, oh my gosh, this is...
Big responsibility.
Right, when a young woman marries, she becomes truly part of her husband's family, right. and they look to us for guidance and support and help with her education, and the full extent of what we were involved with became clear, but she didn't speak much English. Today she has a
Psy D degree,
psychology right. degree. Yeah. And Aaron is a counselor, and we have these two lovely grandchildren, Somayaga and Radhya. And right. So we have become somewhat familiar with the Hindu culture. Any kind of family event like a naming ceremony or
birthdays.
The first bite of solid food. I mean, there's rituals
right.
for each of these stages of life. So we go to the temples and
right, Right. Yeah, it's been a real nice cross-cultural experience. Mm-hmm. And the fact that her mom came over for 9 months when both children were born to help out with the kids was a big blessing, and was a blessing to get to know her, a wonderful woman. So, yeah, it's been a wonderful experience, and we love them dearly.
One of the things I enjoy, Jeff, is watching you with the grandchildren, because you become a different person in some ways. Silly, you know, you make silly faces and you get down on the floor, and it's just a side of you that I hadn't really experienced so much. So that's that grandfathering, grandmothering experience is just so wonderful. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite memories is going up to be with Saraswati right after Soma was born and spending a couple weeks. Right. And her turning to me and saying, "Okay, Mamiji, how do you give a baby a bath?"
Right.
You're asking me how to give a baby a bath. So we went to the Mayo Clinic site. And
on the internet.
On the internet. It came with 15 steps for giving a baby a bath. But it was such a delight to learn about babies at the same time I was learning about grandmothering.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the kind of scary things for me, I think, with the marriage, when my sister and I went over to for the marriage in India, and after the marriage ceremony, Sarah said to me something like, "Well, you know, now we go home with you." And I had to convince her that, no, we can't do that right now, and you and Aaron need to kind of have some time by yourselves, and, you know... But that was just foreign, you know, to their way of being and thinking. And so to take, you know, really to take her on as a daughter in our family was a big step and a great challenge, but also a wonderful gift.
Jeffrey Means talking with his wife, Diane Glass, about his son's marriage. Our final two stories have some similarities. They're both father-daughter pairs. Each of the men grew up on farms in different parts of rural Iowa in the 1930s and 40s. One stayed with farming. The other pursued a different career. In the first story, Lori Phelan interviews her dad, Patrick Phelan, about his life in a rural area northeast of Des Moines. He talks about taking over the family farm after his father's health failed. And he has a special tradition of helping at the local Catholic church, which he lives very close to, in an area where he's lived his entire life.
So, Dad, where do you live?
1.5 miles west of Farrar.
And where were you born?
1.5 miles west of Farrar.
And Iowa, right?
Yes.
So you're 81 years old. And you're living almost where you were born.
Within 1/2 mile.
Yeah. Is that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you tell the story about growing up, you talk about your dad kind of being sick.
Yes.
What was going on with him?
Well, see, Dad was born in 1893, and Mom was born in 1907. And so Dad was a lot older than Mom.
Yeah.
And Dad worked with his parents on the farm about 1 mile from where we're at,
mm-hmm.
and farming. And so Dad was in, he was the oldest child also, so he was in charge of that outfit.
So he was the oldest of their family, and you're the oldest of our family.
Yes.
How did Grandma and Grandpa meet, actually?
At church.
Which church were they going to?
Holy Cross.
Where's that located?
Our house is, and their house is just 1 mile from the Holy Cross Church.
So we didn't get far away to meet our lifelong partners, huh?
No.
So talk about what the house was like and your electricity and water and how were those things?
Well, made? The house was probably 100 years old when we moved in. Electricity wasn't a problem. We didn't have it. We didn't have running water. No bathroom was out on the hill, so that's it.
And you guys thought that that was a perfect life.
It was.
Yeah. You tell us the story, Dad, about that we were poor. Did you think you were poor?
No.
You just, when you were growing up, you didn't know any different.
Well, no one else had anything either. It was just after the Depression.
Right.
Nobody had anything.
So, Dad, what you obviously became a farmer.
Yes.
What made you decide you wanted to be a farmer?
Well, when I was a sophomore in high school, Dad's health wasn't good.
What was wrong with him?
Breathing the oat dust and nightshade in the barn where they thrashed up there, because he was the oldest. He had to mow back the straw and all that. Besides that, he smoked. And so his health was bad, and he was also on a school board. With seven kids in school, it wouldn't be too bad to be on the school board. And so he went to the superintendent, Bill Ganap, and said, "Bill, I'd like to have Pat at home on the days it didn't rain for 2 months, one in the spring and one in the fall." And Bill Ganap, the superintendent, said, "Well, I think it'd be good for you guys to have him on the farm, and I think it'd be good for Pat, and I think it'd be good for the school to have him at home." So Dad, on the way home, said, "What are you doing over there that he'd say that?" And I said, "I'm doing the best I can."
Well, it must have been kind of interesting. You had, when you were growing up, five brothers to help you, and you only had three girls and one son to help you do the actual farm you're farming. How did that go for you?
It made you work.
Yeah, it made us work. But we had some interesting techniques, right?
Yeah.
Like, do you remember when we'd go out to walk the beans, Francie and I'd be in our swimming suits?
You bet. One time you were in your swimming suits out walking the beans, and the neighbor was moving the cattle, and some of them got out and got in the bean field. And here they come up the row. You guys are laying down there in the sun, and you guys jumped up, scared him to death, scared the cows to death.
They took off across the country. Dad, one thing about the church, we live within a half a mile of a little Holy Cross was named after Holy Cross in Ireland.
That's right.
And you've always been the person who's greeting everybody that comes into the church.
Since I live the closest, I go over early, check the furnace, be sure everything's set there, check everything on the inside, scoop the snow or whatever has to be done, and then all ready to go.
And you're
80. Get the altar ready and get the candles lit and all that, and the priest just walks in, says Mass, pats everybody on the back and leaves.
So right now you have this tradition of giving a key out to the church. The church is locked because it's a little country church over by the Chautauqua Reserve, right? Over by Farrar.
Well, they came out from the diocese of Des Moines and found out that we just left it unlocked all the time. So in the wintertime, if somebody got stuck or something, they could go in there and at least they'd be out of the weather. But he came out and he said, "Well, this is what you got to do. You got to start locking the church." And we said, "No, we're not going to do that." And he said, "Well, if you don't, we're not going to insure it." And we said, "Okay." He forgot it. Irish parish. He left, and we said, "This is what we're going to do. Give everybody a key, and we'll also put one underneath the carpet outside the door."
You decided that.
Yes.
Well, as I hear it from the folks at our church, they said, "I know your dad, Pat." And I said, "You do?" And they said, "Yep, after my first day here, he introduced himself to me and gave me a key to the church, and I kept coming back." Pretty good story.
Good story.
Well, what I know is you only had a high school education.
Yes.
You didn't have any money to start your life. You raised four kids.
Yeah.
You have over 500 acres to your mom's name. You traveled the United States.
You guys.
Yes, with us. And to Ireland twice.
Yes.
And you still live within a half a mile of where you grew up.
That's right.
That's a pretty big life, don't you think?
I think it's good.
Yeah, really good.
That was Lori Phelan interviewing her dad, Patrick Phelan. And now we have another father-daughter pair. Sherry Peterson interviews her dad, Clifford Peterson, about growing up in Washington County. He tells her about growing up on the farm, his mom working as a telephone operator, and how he wanted his life to be different from his father's.
So your dad in this picture, if you're like a senior in high school maybe or just graduated.
That's probably about a year before he died.
It's about a year before he died. So how old was he when he died?
58.
58, so my age.
Yeah.
How did he die?
Heart attack. Very unexpected. He ate dinner,
stood up and fell over. So it left her with three little kids. Because I'd already started college. They moved into the big city of Westchester. And Mom was the telephone operator.
Okay. Where were they living?
They lived in the telephone office.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a house. In one room was the telephone switchboard.
Apparatus, yeah.
Switchboard was one room, and they had the other three or four rooms. It was a little brick house.
So you had a kitchen and living room and bedroom and the telephone
basement,
room.
Yeah. Basement was leaky.
I was thinking about it, and, you know, I only know your mom when she was an old grandma.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how you remember her.
Yeah, she was the more loving one in the family. Dad was kind of strict.
And I didn't know him at all.
No.
Of course.
Yeah.
And how do you remember him? What are some of your memories of him?
He had a very short temper and used language that I can't repeat.
Yeah, to anybody.
That I don't want to repeat to
anybody. I mean, like, he would use that language
swear
no matter
up a storm.
Who's... Yeah.
Like a drunken sailor.
Hmm.
So, he was not a very kind or loving person.
Did he have friends?
He belonged to the local lodge in Westchester.
Yeah. Did your mom participate?
She was a Pythian Sisters, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, so she had friends through that.
Yeah. And then, of course, when you have the telephone, you know, you ring, everybody's your friend.
Yikes.
On a party line. Everybody knows what you're doing. And they used to have this thing I always thought was pretty fun. They'd ring them a general ring on the party line and drop everything and come as you are to this certain place to have coffee. Night robes, slippers.
And everybody got the call at the same time.
Yeah, because you run the general ring on the party line, everybody's phone rang.
And then you
just get up there and just ring the hell out of the phone, and everybody's phone would ring.
And then you would all hear the same...
You'd all hear the same message.
...voice on the other end.
And they'd tell you where to go and where to meet.
The ladies would do that.
Come as you are. Slippers, bathrobe, curlers in your hair, whatever. No difference.
Somebody decided she wanted to host. And Did you think about wanting your life to be different from your dad's?
Yes, very much.
You thought about that?
Very much.
And then I
was never going to do what he did.
And I said, and I'm thinking, well, I know your life has been different. And then I wondered how much has been planned and how much just happened.
Well, kind of both.
Yeah.
I went to Iowa State football scholarship, and I got a year of engineering drawing. That engineering drawing got me into Lennox Industries, ended up designing equipment for them. It ended up in the new equipment that they were... And some of that new equipment lasts for years and years and years.
Yeah.
Touched millions of lives.
You can be proud of that.
I am. Yeah. Very proud.
That was Sherry Peterson with her dad, Clifford Peterson, a conversation recorded this summer at the StoryCorps mobile booth in Des Moines. Today's stories were selected and produced by Emily Woodbury, Catherine Perkins, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. On this National Day of Listening, I hope you'll take a few minutes to sit and talk with your family members and maybe even record some of those family stories. You can find out more about how to do it at StoryCorps.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.